It is Saturday, January 3rd, 2015. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
And also Lyle Troxell, photographer, software engineer, and father.
Hello.
Hello. Well, welcome, everyone. Lots of things to talk about. I feel like I haven't been here in ages.
Yeah? It's been a while. It's been a whole year.
Yeah. Well, not a whole year, but it was since last year. And we want to talk about an update on ongoing stories. First off, we've been covering net neutrality, as that's been an issue. And there's been a development from the FCC, I understand, Miles.
Well, the FCC...
You know, so I can't get your mic. Is your mic working, Elise? No, that mic is just, you have to, okay. Everybody shift. Squeaky, squeakies. Bonnie shifts to Miles, 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 shift to him.
All right,
there we go. Hello!
Oh, okay. All right, live radio, you guys.
The FCC says it will vote on net neutrality next month, so February of 2015. And one of the things at issue is whether or not they're going to reclassify existing broadband providers, cable providers, telecommunications who provide internet as a common carrier or as what is referred to as Tier 2. And what goes along with Tier 2 are things like access to utility poles. And this has been something that Google actually has come out and saying, like, hey, yeah, let's do this. Google, among others. Because previously, one of the things that has been a holdup for new companies to get into the market to try to make internet cheaper and faster is that they would have to have some of that infrastructure to be able to put, you know, lay that fiber or lay, you know, whatever coax, you know, onto the nearby poles to do that last mile.
Right.
And if those poles are controlled by an interest such as
a telco or something,
AT&T, then it's in their financial interest to try to make that access as difficult to get as possible.
Hmm.
Tier 2 means that it is a public infrastructure and that it is a public right-of-way, and therefore they would have to give access to third parties.
Okay, so that sort of helps reinforce the argument that this is kind of a public utility and therefore can be regulated the same way that a public utility can. Is that what the vote's
about? Well, that's the argument. If you do make it a Tier 2, if they do find in that mode, then yes, that's a logical conclusion, and that's what the fight is about. And as you can imagine from that, there's a huge amount of money to be gained or lost as a result of this. And this is why it has become so politicized and in many ways made opaque. So it makes it hard for people to understand what's going on, because if nothing happens, it stays exactly the same. And the incumbents, you know,
are still winning.
They want, right?
We still hate our Comcast.
So you actually have to have a proactive change in order to have this Tier 2 set up, in order to have that competition in there. Hmm. So that's where you have this this back and forth and this locking of horns, if you will.
Okay, so if we were to classify all these as a utility at that level, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. what would the how would things change drastically? How would it look
what
like
it
after
mean?
That happened?
Yeah. It means more regulation, right?
Well, it does mean more regulation, but it means more access by upstarts. You're going to see a lot more small companies coming in and wiring up. This is similar to what you saw with back in the day in Santa Cruz. This is my point of reference, SBC Global at the time, getting hit with saying you have to open up your DSL lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you had CruiseIO coming into the DSL space. That mm-hmm. was a direct result of the ruling that said, hey, you can't just monopolize these DSL lines. You have to make them available to other people to use those.
And that's why you can actually get a DSL from someone like CruiseIO, which is a local internet service provider. Actually, CruiseIO folks started GeekSpeak, so we have a real connection with them. In any case, they are able to offer DSL, which is actually served on AT&T's lines
right.
because of this regulation.
Right. And going a little bit further, it's the reason why CruiseIO could service over a modem.
Yeah.
Was because mm-hmm. telephone lines were considered that common carrier
right.
as well.
So if common carrier pushed over to the coaxial cable space, it wouldn't mean necessarily that the cable lines would be usable by anybody, but it would mean that the telephone or the poles, the utility poles that those are on, could be used by anybody? Or did it actually allow people to share
also?
The cable space?
Yeah.
Because the cables, it's a little tricky. I mean, the truth is that when CruiseIO offers DSL through AT&T, AT&T serves the connection to the internet, then connects that line directly to CruiseIO, then CruiseIO then produces the connection to the internet, right? There's a feed through that goes through AT&T.
Yeah. I don't know specifically about coax lines. At the same time, I don't know that that's an issue.
Okay.
Because right now, if anyone's going to be laying new infrastructure or things, it's not going to be coax.
Right.
It's going to be fiber.
Yeah.
Fiber optic cable. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that that would be a concern for an incumbent like Comcast or Time Warner would be things like there's a tendency for people to get an internet connection but without the cable side.
Yeah.
In other words, what they call cutting the cord. So getting your Netflix or your Hulu Plus or HBO Go.
Without getting television cable, the
right.
the money part
and
of the cable.
If you start seeing a lot of other players in there that you can get internet access for, especially if the internet access is comparable in speed or faster or comparable in price or less, then you're going to see more people completely bypassing that revenue stream for those incumbents. And that would be a strong source of concern for them, at least if they didn't improve their services. You know.
Well, it means their karma's doing all right, because cable did the same thing to broadcast television a while ago.
That's true. Yeah.
So.
Well, I for one hope that they become, that this moves forward, that we, and the common carrier pattern gets assigned to cable companies, because it seems like the next best thing, especially when you think of the kind of money that was given to those corporations to put in this infrastructure via tax credit, mm-hmm. and that's how they actually paid for it, was subsidy from the government. To my mind, it is a public utility in a lot of ways, and of course, I can't stand how the lock hold that some of these companies have on access. I use Comcast, can't stand it, but it is the best way for me to get data where I live.
Yeah.
And short of moving, legislation like this would allow other
right.
players
that's
to
that's also
into
been
the
a long-standing thing with a lot of people. Even before the internet hit wildly, it was this notion of, wait, I have this cable company and I don't like them, so let me get, wait, there's no other choice?
There's no other choice.
Wait, so who chose, someone in office who... Okay.
I didn't get to choose. Someone else did. Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to keep following the story. There's a vote in February. Who knows when what they vote on will take effect and what those effects will be. We can guess, but it'll be very interesting to find out just by keeping an eye on it. So we'll do that for you and report what we find here on GeekSpeak. In other updates, we're always sort of nervously looking at robotic advances.
Oh, yes.
And
brain
and also mind controls, another
wait,
thing that we enjoy.
Come on.
I, Bonnie Jean Primsch, observe this with some nervousness.
Is that after seeing Terminator?
Yeah, that was, I don't know. It's just scary, the whole idea. It was also the AI, the one, they move so fast. Anyway.
So Johns Hopkins University has an applied physics laboratory arm called APL.
Mm-hmm.
And this summer, APL did a project with Les Bau, and Les lost both his arms in electrical accident 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Both his arms were, I'm assuming, because
so
his electronics disintegrated
arms for 40 years,
and all the way up to his shoulder. And they have so this project at APL has been to produce an interface for Lee where he can control robotic arms that are mounted to his torso, much like you and I control our weak flesh arms.
Yes.
And what the project has done is, I'll quote, it's a relatively new surgical procedure that reassigns nerves that once controlled the arm and the hand. And this is the John Hopkins trauma surgeon, Albert Chi. By reassigning existing nerves, we can make it possible for people who have had upper arm amputations to control their prosthetic devices by merely thinking about the action they want to perform. And that's exactly what Lee has been able to do. He's been training and working with us since June. And he now can, I mean, it's a great video of him moving things around. And it's like magic. I mean, in the sense that these are just, you know, what we would consider dead, you know, metal and electronics. And he's operating in the world like we would operate in the
world.
He's
having his robot arms do his bidding. Yes. So take that, overlords.
Yeah, and I just want to say, I, for one, welcome our new non-weaky flesh hand overlords.
Yes, very good.
Nicely done, sir. Nicely
done. So we're going to have that video up at our website, geekspeak.org. In fact, our intern Chandler is currently putting links up at our show page so you can observe what we're talking about as we are talking about it. Thank you, Chandler. Much appreciated.
In fact, Chandler, go ahead and make that show page live by editing that show and say, make it live. And then we'll see
an
ongoing
update.
Yeah. It doesn't look good in the beginning, let me tell you. We don't have a title till the end of the show. So.
Yes.
There you go.
Please enjoy our show today called Working Title. Okay. This is Geek Speak here on KUSP. Any other updates? What's going on with HTTP, Lyle?
Well, this is kind of an ongoing story as well. In some sense, we've talked about it before, but I don't know if we actually really covered it well. What's happening in the security world that we live in, it's very clear we have to be better about being safe on the internet, even better than we have before. And one of the things that's very clear with the Snowden leaks is that the U.S. government and therefore, you can assume others just collect all data that goes across the internet. There's actually pipes. There's actually connections to fiber optic lines. And anything that goes on the internet gets recorded. And it looks like in the more recent discussions that data is getting saved for like 15 years. And it's pretty aggressive. Now, most of this is kind of shocking and surprising, all that. But there is something you can do pretty easily to kind of counter that. And that is to try to encrypt stuff more often. And the reason that is important is that if you just tap a network connection kind of passively and record everything, the encrypted stuff will not be really accessible. But, don't get me wrong, NSA can still very easily grab data from someone that's using HTTPS, the protocol that I'm talking about right now, because they can probably make certificates on the fly that make them impersonate. But we won't get into that detail. The point is that the kind of raw record everything works if you're using a protocol called HTTP. That's the standard protocol on the net. And you'll notice that And you'll notice that over the years, the big companies, we've talked about this on GeekSpeak regularly, will switch over to HTTPS as their default protocol. So I think in 2014, at one point, Twitter said, yep, HTTPS all the way, which means you can't actually use the service without going secure. And that means there's an encryption going on the entire time.
Yeah.
So Google has been pushing this idea of making that more and more more common to do HTTPS. But the trick is, the way that would work is that the providers that are making websites, anybody that hosts a website, has to actually get a certificate, which costs some money, and apply it to their system so that it actually works. Mm-hmm. And that process will take a geek a few hours and take, you know, $150 a year, something like that. Now, at the same time, the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is working on a project that will launch in the first quarter of 2015, or maybe the second quarter of 2015, which will give free certificates to anybody and a protocol. Yeah,
Miles.
Yeah.
Point of order. They will be the second one.
Oh, who's doing it now?
Start SSL already provides free certs.
Okay, so it's not just this free quality of it. It's actually the way they'll be implementing it, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. So Start SSL?
StartSSL.com.
Okay. So if you're hosting a website and don't use HTTPS and you actually host it yourself, you could get a free certificate with Start SSL.
Right. But this new one also will allow more expansive certificates, not just the single host, but the wildcards.
Right.
And the
well, the tradition, specifically what they're planning is a kind of a protocol where they'll be doing a handshake with a website to quickly create these things. So you'll be able to set up a quick SSL certificate with your site that can get authenticated because you put a file up on your web page. So it's a very simple process. And to kind of streamline it and to make it easier. I mean, the trick is, for years, I've known that I could get free SSL certificates or a cheap one. That's not something but I still haven't done it for GeekSpeak. And the reason is, it's a bit of a barrier. So as we get more and more support to do it free and easy, it becomes less of a barrier for little websites to add SSL. Mm-hmm. The other thing, and that's one important piece to make it easy and cheap to do. And then the proposed protocol would be that you'd put a plug-in to the web server, and the web server would, and you put in authentication tokens privately to the provider, and you could mint and create certs that are short-lived and get downloaded and automatically installed on your server. I won't get into the details of that, but it's a cool way of thinking about future possibilities.
Yeah, although we have been dragging our feet on that, and we shouldn't be at the same time. It's like, oh, we post links to sites
to other sites
that aren't using HTTPS.
Well, Miles
is
saying is that we're not doing what we preach.
Geekspeak.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the HTTPS making it easier for people to do this. But the other thing that Google's been doing is they've been lined out two different things that will kind of suggest and force people to switch over to SSL. And that is to, one, they've suggested in 2015, I was curious if it was going to happen right away. It hasn't happened yet. The Chrome browser is supposed to start notifying people when you're not using HTTPS. And that would become some kind of warning. And they even recommended to other browser manufacturers in an RFC that you should do this as well, meaning that if you're...
They're trying to create a new standard.
They're trying to warn people, yeah. Uh-huh. And in fact, they're trying to kind of...
Well, it's social engineering, the security.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of times social engineering is used for phishing attacks to try to circumvent security. Here, you're putting up a message for the human user so that they feel kind of anxious about going to a site that doesn't have HTTPS.
Uh-huh.
In other words, you're putting that social pressure from the users to go to the site and say, hey, what's going on with this?
It's also an inversion of how we think about security notification in a browser. What we've been seeing for years is when you are using HTTPS, you get a green symbol or a little lock. There's notification that you're using something secure as a positive. Mm-hmm. This flips that model. This now will switch it to say you are doing something bad when you're not using HTTPS.
Okay.
The thing that's frustrating is the only recourse an individual user has, they can try accessing the website with HTTPS. But if the website hasn't done that, you can't. You just can't use that service. Right. And so like you can't go to geekspeak.org securely. So when the warnings start happening, we'll lose traffic. The other thing that Google's announced...
Interact with us, you're taking your security into your hands.
Yeah, don't log in with us, that's for sure. So the last piece that they've done
Can people log in with us?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Well, you can make comments on the Tumblr blog if you want, yeah. I mean, we're around. Don't get me wrong. Go to Google Plus and Facebook and Twitter and make comments to us.
We're communicatable.
Oh, yeah, please. But we just don't host the service that does that because we're lazy geeks. So the last
piece of... support HTTPS.
That's the reason, yeah. So the last...
if someone wanted to give us $150, we could look into it.
Yeah, Miles, that might motivate you to get a cert going.
No, not so much.
Maybe we'll teach Chandler how to do HTTPS certs and he can help us with it. Okay, so the last piece is that they're actually also saying, that Google's also saying that ranking of your website in search engine results will be changed and impacted by HTTPS.
Really? So they're going to sort for most secure first?
They're going to give a little bit of weight to the search results. Now, this is a major business. Like
that, yeah.
Search results are...
That's putting some support behind it.
Absolutely. So they're putting their money where their mouth is on that. And that, again, that's a motivation. That's the most motivation for me for us to get a cert, actually, so more people can find us.
Yeah.
But I think we have other SEO problems on geekspeak.org. All right. So there you go. HTTPS, HTTPS.
Look at that.
I'm hoping that 2015 is the year HTTP becomes less common than HTTPS. But I think that it's going to be a couple of years.
You know, you can have something to do with that, Lyle.
Oh, okay.
You
can help.
I host
that 15 websites.
Yeah,
that's true.
Wait a minute. Maybe we'll check in with you about
we'll
how
keep
that
you up
project's
to date.
Going for you.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep it as the EFF's project goes online. Yeah. We'll definitely mention that on GeekSpeak.
Yeah, okay. Someone make a note of that. 2015 is the year of going HTTPS. We're going to talk about more future developments and how that security might affect the other idea about 2015 is that it might be the year of the cyber war. That's coming up on Geek Speak here on KUSP. As a fan of this program, you may consider also checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9 or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. In the show every week, Robert talks with a bright mind in the arts or sciences, and then we all get to listen in. That's the 7th Avenue Project. It's Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauly, and it airs tomorrow at noon on KUSP. You can also check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. But right now, it's us. It's the Geeks on GeekSpeak. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch. With me in the air room is Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam and our intern Chandler catching us up as live on geekspeak.org, where you can find out more about all of the things we're talking about today. And let's talk about Sony.
Yeah, or security.
And security in general. But let's start with Sony. They are recently trying to do something about all the leaking, Miles. and started trying
to protect... leaking miles. What?
They're leaking miles and miles of emails and trying to keep other people from using that in untoward ways.
Oh, put my name in there too. Can you do that?
No, that's trickier.
With great style.
Yeah, no, can't do
so
it.
So Sunny is sending Digital Millennium Copyright Act notices against users that have
rebroadcast their emails.
Right.
That's great.
And
don't.
Okay, so the reason why. Okay, why is this funny? I mean, why am I laughing? Do you think? Because it's a large
because
context.
Sony is one of the people sending out I don't know exactly. Okay. I'm not going to speak to your motives.
Yeah, okay. So the reason I laugh about this is that the Digital Right Millennium Copyright Act is this piece of legislation that is basically made the web a harder place to participate in. The MPAA
had... Well, in fairness, it has a lot of provisions to it. Some of them were good.
Yeah.
Just...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but a few of them are about... it makes more opaque what happens in your computer system. So the Copyright Act, which was kind of pushed forward by the MPAA, which Sony Entertainment, of course, is one of the members.
The music industry in
general. The music industry in general. But the film industry,
industry
in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
The Act says, one of the things that it says, one of the provisions says that if someone has put any kind of measure on a system that has to try to hide what's going on, if you try to figure out that system, you're breaking the law. So this means that you can't backwards engineer. You can't figure things out legally.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means basically is it's a fight against knowledge. It's a very anti-geek thing to do, right? Anti-maker thing to do.
Right, yeah.
And it codifies and puts into law this legislation that basically says if you try to figure something out, you could be breaking the law just by figuring it out. Not by doing anything, not by copying something that you don't have copyright access to, you don't have rights to, but just to figure it out in general, which stymies the creativity process, and it actually stymies the ability for us to enhance and improve security. I would say one of the reasons why systems aren't as secure as they are is because if you would play in that space, you're doing something that's slightly shady and potentially against the law. So at these hacker conventions, people make talks about security vulnerabilities and problems, and then get and if they do it incorrectly, they can get fined and go to prison because they figured out that a company was insecure.
Okay.
So then Sony gets hacked because of a vulnerability. And now, after that, their information gets sent out. And then they use the same act that restricted people to figure out solutions to hacking or to cracking things.
Yeah.
They use that same act to target people that are then showing how their business works, things that are copyrightable.
So let me see if I can put a metaphor on this. They were using this sort of blunt instrument. And it prevents people from being able to be more sort of facile and elastic in responding to hacks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now they're using that same blunt tool to try to prevent people from talking about those hacks.
Well, I would say from what they're trying to use the copyright. I mean, Miles, it's your story. So what they're doing now is saying, look, if you're rebroadcasting any of our emails, that's a copyright infringement, right?
Yeah, which seems an odd on it.
It's an odd use of the one tool they've got. That's right, what it sounds right. like.
Well, the thing is, all the data that was taken from them, that is theft.
Yeah.
And so I don't know that copyright is necessarily the reason why you would say you can't have that. But at the same time, the DMCA does put in provisions for enforcement that may not be as clear in other venues. But the thing behind this that I find interesting is that the internet is, I think of all those, the nude celebrity photos that were stolen and disseminated, that it was a social program to get people not to look at them that kept it off the web.
Yeah.
Because if you just try to force it off the internet, it's like getting pee out of a pool after you've already peed in it. Just doesn't...
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
What a colorful metaphor.
Well, it's a little yellow. But the thing here, though, is that I almost worry that they're making a Streisand effect out of this. In other words, this came from the eponymous person who...
May I?
Yes. Please describe the Streisand effect.
It's somebody who is into sort of drone photography, flew over Barbara Streisand's house and and basically photographed and published a photograph of an aerial view of her place, and she went, "Don't!" And everyone went, "What?" And take a look.
And so everybody paid attention after she mentioned it.
Right. So that's the Streisand effect.
Okay.
And now it's kind of like jumping the shark. It's referred to, it's like the term of use when someone protests and then causes more people to look at the thing they're protesting that they don't want them to see.
Right. Sure. Now, Sony has a whole bunch of people looking at their stuff, and that horse has already left the barn.
Right.
I'm like throwing all my cliches off.
Yeah.
And
it seems a little late, frankly.
But at the same time,
if they don't show that they're upset about that and they don't make a precedent to it, they're not making up the same kind of public statement they could make. Right.
That's true.
So
now the thing is, if it's personal emails, I could totally see them doing it. I wonder though, what will happen if something comes up where people are digging through these emails and they find some comment by a senior VP, for example, mm-hmm. where they were, doing something untoward, if they were doing something extremely racist, for example, or mm-hmm. if they were doing something
criminal.
Well, there's already examples of sexism. That's the first right. news story we covered was actually
right. And
a
someone,
sexist story.
And someone posts that.
Yeah.
Is that public interest and therefore safe harbor, or is that still under the copyright? That's what I wonder about.
That's what the lawyers are going to have fun about.
Well,
there's going to be some fun legal arguments coming up.
You can't copyright facts, right? So theoretically, if you don't republish that, you just learn the knowledge from that, and then you say, here are facts, like this person operated in this, you know, sexist way. It's harder to report the story, definitely, especially since it's theft that got the stuff. But I don't think that would deter the knowledge from escaping, and I don't think it would block.
Except, a term of fact seems, well,
any case,
yeah,
my take on it is that the emails and all that content is private information. You should not rebroadcast that information. At the same time, I hope journalists use that information to potentially write stories that's good journalism about what's going on in the corporation, because I think that understanding how a corporation operates is really important for our society. We rely on them to be arbiters of almost everything. So,
and is there a Snowden correlation also?
I don't know. I don't think
certainly
so.
Certainly not in the importance
scale. I definitely don't think
scale.
I don't think releasing this content with the same type of nobility that Snowden
like
did.
Ragging on Adam Sandler is not the same as.
But let's talk about the Sony hack and who participated in it and how it happened. Right.
Right. So, now there's some various theories out there about who did it. FBI is saying North Korea. I don't know. Like one security firm looked into it and thought it was a Sony disgruntled ex-employee. Some
yeah,
people looked
our,
at
our Southern
linguistic.
California. Yeah, our Southern California security correspondent thinks that it is, in fact, North Korea.
Well, he actually – so yeah. I mean, first off, the U.S. is clearly saying that the reason why the person that actually did the attack was the North Koreans, right? Mm-hmm. That's very clearly what the U.S. is doing. In fact, we're sanctioning the North Korean ambassadors, if you will, all across the nation. Obama's made a few speeches about this. And the tricky thing is that the FBI released this accusation report that said that it was North Koreans relatively soon after the attack happened. In early December, they did this. And at the same time, what they said in the report, the FBI said in the report, was not a very good technical argument in a lot of ways. And so there are some pretty prominent security experts saying, you know, actually, that's not good enough. Can you please be more specific? And the federal government is just saying, I'm sorry, we can't be more specific because it's secrets. It is secrets of why we know it's the North Koreans. And the tricky thing about this, of course, that the FBI knows more about what happened with security breach than anybody else, because they got into
Sony. Say some stuff and they're not going to say some stuff.
They are. That's right. And it does make sense for governments to hold secrets. But the thing that's so tricky about this is that from a security, the way the security world kind of works is somebody will release, hey, we found this virus, and they'll show the definition, and then all the security companies kind of investigate it, and they all share the knowledge of what's going on. And that's why when you run a virus protection software on your computer, it works, because all these corporations and groups are working to try to fight the problem. Mm-hmm. So when you say, well, we know it was this group, but you don't specify how, you don't educate the rest of the security community on how to protect. So basically, you know, the next company, unless the federal government's helping the corporation directly, won't know the reason why they know. Now, the reason might be, as some have claimed, it might be completely traditional intel, right? It might be that they tapped someone's phone and they know that the order went out and all of that. But most likely, it's a signature of the code. It's other stuff. And one of the quotes that the FBI, or one of the examples the FBI has given, is that the signature of this code looks like other code that was attacked, what they claim was attacks of North Korea.
Yes, the state of North Korea, not just a North Korean person.
And I think what's interesting here is that when a government says, we know the truth here, this is the truth, and we're going to act in this way, it is a there's a very hard question for citizens to make.
Well, especially,
is that true or not?
I mean, there's a precedence in this country of weapons of mass destruction. We've seen them, so now we have to act. And then it turns out later there were no weapons of mass destruction. So, you know, I applaud the skepticism and the further analysis that's happening around who really made these attacks and not wanting to trust the FBI wholesale and what they're saying.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, I'd be interested to hear more about what people are citing as their reasons for why they think it was, for instance, a disgruntled ex-employee. What is it about the linguistic signatures of the writing itself and the warnings that makes some people think it was Russians were involved?
Right.
You know? And are the people publishing that actually North Korea trying to deflect blame for what happened? You know, there's all sorts of unknowable potential intrigue that we may never find out.
And for that matter, how much moral ground does the U.S. have when it was one of the co-authors of Stuxnet, that attack that was a nation-state attack upon, in this case, Iran, and their centrifuge technology
that was used for potentially for nuclear weapons, but definitely for nuclear power plants. It's very clear that the signatures of that hack were actually state-sponsored, the U.S. state, and that was a security attack that happened.
U.S. and Israel,
2013, I think, actually, when that happened. So to be clear, I didn't read all the documentation of the FBI's announcement. I am looking at security experts that I respect, looking at it and going, you know, this doesn't seem like enough knowledge here. And I don't trust that it necessarily is North Korea. And I said that last week on GeekSpeak as well. And the reason for that is the actual, you know, the reason why it would be North Korea is that Sony was releasing this movie that kind of was negative on the North Korean dictator.
Number one.
Yeah.
And number two, you should so too take us seriously.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's that sort of general stamping of the foot.
At the
also.
Same and any time a thing happens like this, you look at, you know, what the negative side effects are and what the positive side effects are, right? So the negative side effects of all these people that work for Sony, private information, you know, damaging to people's lives.
Embarrassing
right?
also.
Yeah, it's just a mess.
Yeah.
And the side effect of it, of course, is that every security company, every company in the U.S. right now is listening more to their CTO chief technical officer.
Yeah.
There you go. CTO, yeah.
CTO.
When they say we need more money for security, right? So there will be an increase in security.
CIO, the chief information officer.
Thank you. That's the word I was looking for. Gosh, man. So, and the other thing that's clear is that Alex Lee, our Southern correspondent, has said very clearly that this looks like a state-sponsored attack because of its scale.
Yeah.
And that does kind of show that, well, if we're seeing nation states attacking corporations, we're starting to see it's the second attack. If you think of the Stuxnet as the first attack, it's the second major attack from a state-to-state kind of level that made press. So the U.S. population, the world populations, is starting to understand that cyber warfare is a real thing, right?
Right.
And it's exemplifying that.
Followed on the heels by somebody attacking a South Korean nuclear power plant and releasing blueprints, releasing employee information, releasing testing data, installing malware. So it's on. Basically, it's on. Which is why some are saying 2015 may be the year of the cyber war.
Yeah.
But also, a fuzzing up of who fights who. Nations are fighting corporations.
Right. Why are they
There's some acknowledgement of the power of corporations also there.
Yeah, definitely.
And that sort of gets to the an old story about it's no longer about nations, it's about corporations running the world.
When the NSA is tapping Angela Merkel's phones, aren't we already in a cyber war and information gathering?
Yeah.
I think that's also specifically using cyber hacks to attack.
The other interesting aspect of this is this is this first kind of attack of the U.S. at a large scale, if you will. It's a corporation, but it's also an entertainment corporation, right? Mm-hmm.
It gets us where we live.
Yeah, well, the biggest export of the United States is entertainment, right? Our mm-hmm. culture export is mm-hmm. our kind of big export. And so it's interesting to see that it's, a large entertainment company. But of course, it's also a Japanese company, right? It's not really a U.S. company. It's a Japanese company, which is also interesting. Of course, it's a multinational company. Yeah. It's not, corporations don't really have lines of borders anymore.
Yeah, it's the name is Japanese, right? But at the same time.
But all the employees,
Of the motion picture arm is definitely an American
institution. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Mm-hmm. If you want to do work in the movies, you got to be in Hollywood. That's for sure.
So you bet we're going to be watching that and developments in that general topic also.
As we do. We always cover security stuff, so we'll definitely continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, more on everything we've talked about so far at geekspeak.org. I could use a little unicorn chaser there before we go to a break. What do you think? Given that entertainment is where we live, entertain me, Lyle.
Well, I can say that everyone's heard of They Might Be Giants. I'm hoping you guys know They Might Be Giants.
All right-thinking people have heard of They Might Be Giants. They're very easily Googleable. You can go ahead and do that right now as we're talking.
So years ago, They Might Be Giants had a phone number, an answer machine, dial a slip. Now you remember
Free When You Call from Work? Yeah, I remember that.
Free When You Call from Work. So Dial-A-Song is a service that Dial-A-Song was a service that they ran for years. And
it started off as an answer machine, right?
Yeah, it still is,
I think. And it was how they sort of got a renown in a pre-internet era. The word just got around that there was this Dial-A-Song thing. And, increasingly higher up people in the entertainment industry would tune in or dial in to hear what the song of the day was.
That's right. And they are relaunching the service, and they're actually doing it in collaboration with The Gist, which is a podcast I listen to and love from Slate.com.
Okay.
And every Monday on Slate, they'll release the song mm-hmm. of the week, and then it will be available at 844-387-6962.
That's 844-387-6962.
But unfortunately, and kind of fun, only one person can call at a time. So if you get through, congratulations. Their song right now, because the Monday of 2015, the first one hasn't shown up, so they're just using a song that they've had for years.
It's a theme song.
Exactly, really. It's a theme song. And this is a sample of it. So they're using their theme, their Dial-A-Song theme song, if you will, for their first pre-release. So Dial-A-Song you can also get to at dialasong.com. And The Gist, of course, is available up at geekspeak.org. You can click over to that. It's a wonderful podcast produced almost daily, kind of cultural events and things. And, of course, they had They Might Be Giants on, so you got to love them.
Got to love them.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, next week, let's tune in and see what they did for their first song.
Okay.
It is Geek Speak here on KOSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the studio with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. And let's do some more newsy bits. Aircrafts, global warming. How responsible are they?
Well, to put it in perspective, if the aviation industry was a nation, mm-hmm. it would be in the
They would have so much difficulty landing.
It would be one of the world's, it would be in the top 10 of the world's top CO2 emitters.
Okay.
Just the aviation industry.
The industry is equal to a country.
Right, which competes with all the cars that are on the road, like in every country, and all the factories and things like that.
So they'd be a first world country, because aren't we the worst emitters?
Yeah, I think so.
In general? In part because we fly, I guess.
Can you put that in a different context? Because for me, taking a spread out system of problems and coalescing it into one location and then equating it to the rest of the locations is a weird way of thinking about problem. It's like taking all the car industry would be almost like,
well, it's not. Like it's country-based. Aircraft is 2.5% of all global carbon dioxide emissions.
Okay. Now that is a figure
That's
I can understand.
That's a significant fraction.
Okay. Now, that's a lot of points.
Another one is one round trip flight between Denver and New York City is the equivalent CO2 emission of driving a 44-mile-per-gallon car 7,500 miles. In other words, driving a typical year years driving
is
of a
one
reasonably
back and forth
efficient
flight.
Car
across the country.
Yeah.
So, but the air flight takes 200 people, and the car takes 3 really uncomfortable people. So, I mean, isn't it? Is that per person, or is that?
But at the same time,
it's a lifetime of a. I mean, it's a year of a car.
Right.
Use is the same as one. Or three hour flights, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, okay. I mean, the general message is air flight is impactful.
Yeah.
So what do we do about it?
2.5% of 2.5% the carbon dioxide poisoning. So exhaust. That's a problem.
That's a problem, right?
Right. And it's a problem that has to deal with basic physics. There's no real way around it.
That's the tricky one.
Aircraft are heavy. Mm-hmm. The people inside are getting heavier.
And if you look at vehicles on the roads, everyone can do what I do and be awesome and switch to electric, and then they won't have CO2 direct. And of course, the power source still produces CO2.
Or take public transit.
But the point is that cars and trains and trucks can theoretically all go onto another way of doing, not have fuel that burns. But planes are different.
Planes are different. Although Branson has been Richard Branson of Virgin Airlines has been looking at this, sort of understanding early on how impactful plane flight is on the general planet health. And looking into things like, I don't know, algae for biofuel, which seems like it would take up a lot of land space. So I'm not sure what else
It would help, though, because, of course, as you create that biofuel, it sequesters carbon. So that's why it's a really good thing, right? Mm-hmm. Even though when you burn it again.
Oh, it helps and helps.
Yeah, you consume it in the greenery, and then you turn it into fuel, and then
it
you burn it.
Up some of
so
stuff.
It's kind of a circular thing, yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
All right.
Right, and I'm not going to go into detail, but the article that linked up on geekspeak.org is also about ways to mitigate it, trying to deal with different fuels, trying to deal with making aircraft more efficient in terms of design.
But at the same time, Miles, for years I've just kind of accepted that planes and rocket ships are going to need to burn a lot of fuel, right? Like they're going to make a lot of carbon dioxide. But if we reduced everything else we were doing to almost nothing, it wouldn't matter. You know, we couldn't fly enough necessarily to actually have a problem if that was our only output. But of course, we also have, I don't know, cows, which are kind of a problem. Wow. And, you know, exactly. And other fuel sources. So I've just accepted for a long time planes are going to be doing this whole burning thing because it's just the way to produce. It's cheap, it's easy, and it's good density of energy. You know, it comes out of a physics problem.
But. Right, and I do know people that are choosing not to fly. Like they would like to go world traveling but have said, you know, I'm not going to because all of that is going to add to CO2 emissions.
Oh, I have a suggestion.
I do want people
that,
to keep in mind, though, that a non-trivial amount of the aircraft travel is shipping all of those Amazon goods, for example.
Yeah, so
shipping is a huge aircraft industry. Also, just mail in general.
That's why you should invest in 3D printing and drones.
Because then,
impact of all that shipping.
Well, it's true. 3D printing would reduce shipping.
Yeah.
Except, I mean, you know, because then you can just make stuff on site.
As long as you ship the printers.
No, you reuse the printers. All those horrible printers you have, you cut them up and then it become plastic and then you put them in your new printer. And then you make stuff with it.
I'm sure that's how it works.
That's how it works, I'm pretty sure.
You just mix it up in a bowl.
Get a bit of chopping blades.
And that's a little robot egg basically. Is a binder.
Mm. And then you wave a magic wand.
Yeah. Speaking of cooking things up, is it really true that you can put a MacBook Pro in the oven to fix it?
Now, in the past, we have covered...
What?
In the past, we have covered things like don't put your cell phone into a microwave to get it charged.
Why? What? Why people do that?
There was a hoax on there that told people you can charge your cell phone by putting it into a microwave. And it was absolutely wrong. And people were ruining their cell phones that way.
And their microwave.
Yes. This, on the other hand, turns out to be legit.
What?
Is it a drying out thing? Is it if you dunk it or
no,
something?
It's not a drying out thing. It's over time, because of the thermal expansion and contraction over time. So when your computer is on, when things heats up, you start ending up stretching out the solder joints.
Mm-hmm.
And then after you turn it off, it cools off and you have a little bit of flex and you end up with cracking. At the solder points. And so you end up with loose connections, which leads to a computer that doesn't work very well. And so after person found that their MacBook Pro wasn't working anymore.
Now, when you say it weren't working, not even booting.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So it's very specific. If your machine's a little slow, don't put it in the oven.
Right.
Not being able to turn it on.
Right.
And what's the
if it's dead anyway?
If it's dead anyway. Okay. There you go. That's when you put things in the oven. It's dead
that's
anyway.
When you risk.
Right. Yeah. Lobsters can go hot into boiling water, but other things, and they go in the oven, they have to be dead already.
Right. Right. So okay, tried a couple of things, like the typical. Use compressed air to blow out the dust from the fans, which is something you should do, and tried other things, making sure the fans were spinning correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But then, when it didn't work, drilled a couple of holes in the case to add some ventilation, and then put it into the oven.
This is advanced geekery, people.
Right, at 350 degrees.
Okay.
And
set a timer.
Yeah, set a timer. And basically, it was at that point, that temperature, where the solder starts to liquefy again.
Uh-huh.
But it isn't completely cooking everything. Like 350 degrees is still...
And this person took the hard drive
soft.
Out, right? Because the hard drive wouldn't do well at that temperature. Jeez. That's so cool. And did they recover it? Did the person recover
And the laptop started working again.
Yay.
Unfortunately, couldn't use it because it was too hot.
Remember to use your pot holders.
No, I mean, before doing this, like, opened up the laptop, yes, took out various parts, took off heat sinks.
Yeah, so this person reflowed the solder joints, basically I mean, and that's true that kind of thing would work, but there are a lot of components that never...
And then also put on the thermal paste well, which is a problem actually with MacBook Pros, that the thermal paste is put on too thickly.
All right. And yes, you can flow in an oven, but this is an advanced technique. I wouldn't recommend this for most people.
No, but if you do want to try it, at least read about it. iFixit.org is the article, and we'll have it at our website, geekspeak.org, so don't freestyle this one.
Yeah.
Unless you have a spare MacBook Pro that you just really want to kind of screw with.
Well, on the contrary, if your MacBook Pro is already broken, if the logic board is already broken.
Yes.
What's the worst that's going to happen?
Okay, here's the worst that's going to happen. When you put a circuit board into an oven to solder it, so you do you do solder paste screening, and then you put all the components down, probably robotically all get placed down, and then you bake that thing. Yeah. It heats everything up. Then after that, you attach the components that can't be heated by hand or by another form. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of stuff on your board and in your computer that doesn't have the ability to heat up that temperature.
Yeah.
So, for example, I don't know, the USB port might not support that kind of heat. So what this person did was risky-ish but also interesting and might have lost some components. So I'm just saying, I've done a lot of electronics and totally baking stuff makes sense, but then parts go on that can't be baked and they're attached.
Ask a hardware professional before trying this
at home.
There
you go.
No, as I was saying, if the system's already busted,
oh, my phone's cracked. Let me put it in the oven. I mean, it's
right, and very
that's true. You can cook it.
And very, very important, don't put your screen in there.
Yeah. You also have to detach the LCD from the laptop, which is easy to do.
Yeah, you're just taking the main. They're basically taking the main board
the
out,
motherboard.
And taking everything.
This kind of a fix makes me wonder if we really are living in the future.
Yeah. Throwing it in the oven.
Aren't we?
Well, what kind of oven was it?
Arms,
that's the question.
I thought we were in the future, but just like fixing your computer in the oven.
I used to have to. One of the things with the early Mac, the Mac Pluses, the 512s, those early like really cool gray boxes, which I love the look of. Those things had actually a problem with this kind of soldering, and it you could fix it by resoldering it. And it wasn't a full bake; it was touch the solder points, and it's time consuming because that was a through hole board. But anyway, we won't get into that. So,
is it a time saver if you have to remove all the components? All right. More about it at geekspeak.org.
All right.
I'm done talking about it. Is Back to the Future upon us, Lyle?
You know it. You know it is. Actually, it's Back to the Future is in October of this year, meaning that when you saw the Back to the Future movie, he goes to the future.
Oh, he goes
second movie, they go into the future.
Right.
And Marty McFly is put into 2015, October of 2015. That's when the time frame is.
That's coming up.
So in the film, there's a whole bunch of examples of the kind of things that we had in 2015.
Uh-huh.
You recall that all the cool kids used hoverboards. They were like skateboards,
but they
didn't have wheels, which is very cool.
We still have 10 months to make that happen, people.
That's right. And, of course, dogs walked by themselves with flying leashes that followed them. Do you recall this?
No.
So the dogs in the street, in the Marty McFly's street, were being walked by these robots that just had a leash connected to the dog, and it was like a flying disc.
Oh, like a little drone.
Exactly like a drone. In fact, it is a drone. It's a hovering circular thing. Here's a photo from the film, geeks, and you see that it looks like a dog's being walked by a drone.
Yeah.
There's actually a drone that someone has that has a tether like that, so it looks exactly like that, which is kind of cool.
Okay.
The question, of course, always becomes, did the drones get created in that shape and form because of the Marty McFly films, right? I mean,
yeah, that's what you get.
Nature sometimes
effect.
Copies art. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's also that issue of how does a drone hold back a Rottweiler?
Well, yeah, there's the dog has to be well trained. I would assume electrical shock. Exactly, yeah. The drone can taser the dog. Biometrics was used. The scanning of eyes and fingerprints used in the film to check people's identities.
That's
of course,
happening.
We do that.
Yep,
in fact, everyone carries it with them.
Yep.
So I highly recommend. First off, if you haven't seen the film or the film series Back to the Future, it's
a good
great
time to
series.
Review.
Oh, so much fun! I think I'm gonna watch it with the kids. And definitely October of this year will be the time to really sit down. So. And
I want to know where my 3D film marquees are coming
yes.
from. The giant
the
shark
projected
that goes
sharks,
to eat
yes.
him. That's what I'm looking for.
That can't
for.
Be
you
too
know, that
far
whole
away.
Projecting an empty space is really hard.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. That's Geek Speak for the day. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Miles Elam and Lyle Troxell and our intern Chandler. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so do use our stuff. But cite your sources. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. Today's theme music is by Michael Newman of Pitstart Music. And thank you so much for being here for our first episode of 2015.
Woohoo!
Ow!